Hello and welcome to Canary Pods, a podcast from the team behind The Canary. I'm journalist Steve Topple, and I'm sitting in the chair for our editor-in-chief, Kerri-Anne Mendoza, today. She's not well, so some collective R's again, please, from everyone at home. Thank you. So, every week, we bring you a look behind the scenes at some of the biggest stories of the past 7 days. Today, we're doing a Brexmas carol. Yes, we are. Those of you who follow our cheeky satirical section, Off the Perch, will have seen that I've been satirising Dickens' A Christmas Carol, taking a look at Ebba Teresa Scrooge and her encounters with some less than welcome spirits, Thatcher's ghost, and glimpsing into her past, present and future. Ooh! So, with this in mind, I thought we'd look at some of the things haunting our struggling Prime Minister. And on this podcast, she's going to be visited by three ghosts. We'll be meeting the ghost of Christmas past, looking at 7 years of demonic attacks and grave and systematic human rights violations her party has meted out on disabled people, culminating in a massive court victory this week. Then the ghost of Christmas present will be making an appearance, looking at the ongoing crisis in the NHS that continues to haunt our weak and wobbly Prime Minister, and also the situation at present in the health service. And finishing off, the ghost of Christmases yet to come will be visiting us, along with Jeremy Corbyn's prediction that he'll be Prime Minister in 12 months, and also what 2018 could have on the cards for the crestfallen, browbeaten Theresa May. So, joining me to put a canary twist on the spooky tale of Tory ghouls and government ghosts is UK and Discovery editor John Ranson, weekend editor Emily Apple, and writer Freya Lockley. Afternoon all.
Hello.
Hiya.
Hello. We have the A-team assembled today, so let's have a look at a Brexmas carol then, guys. Okay, so first up, we're going to talk to Emily and the ghost of Christmas past. Emily, there was a really interesting edition of the Andrew Marr show this week, wasn't there? And dare we say it, Andrew Marr was actually quite good, wasn't he? Talk us through that.
Oh, he really was. Marr was questioning Gawk about the effect that sanctions on benefits have had. And even Marr could see that Gawk had no idea what he was talking about. He said to him, oh, part of the problem is that perhaps your department doesn't really know very much about the effect of the sanctions that you're in charge of on actual people, which pretty much sums up the problem in that nobody in the Department of Work and Pensions seems to know, understand, or care what their policies are and how they impact on people, especially on disabled people.
Yes.
And this ignorance isn't really an excuse. You know, as Marr said to him, you know, this is an argument where the professionals are on the other side to you. And this is the point, is there's been so much evidence of the impact that sanctions are having on people. In February, leading psychological and psychotherapeutic bodies called on the government to scrap benefit sanctions and said that they see evidence which links sanctions to destitution, disempowerment, and increased rates of mental health problems.
Absolutely. Sorry, just to interrupt, I just want to sort of rein it back a little bit. Obviously, we're looking at this quite lightheartedly this week, a Brexmas carol, but this is a very serious subject. And you wrote the piece, and I was so proud of you. You wrote the piece from the point of view of the fact you're a disabled person yourself, aren't you?
Yes.
This is quite kind of personal to you, and it's personal to me as well. I was on the ESA for quite a while, and as a lot of people know, my girlfriend Nicola Jeffrey, she lives with a chronic genetic illness, so this is sort of this is personal to us, and you wrote it from that stance, didn't you?
Absolutely, because one of the things that's been making me, well, actually just very, very angry recently is this mantra that the Tories keep spouting, that they're trying to help disabled people into work and doing everything that they can to get disabled people into work. And I've had mental health problems throughout my life. I used to get disability living allowance. I used to be on incapacity benefit. And when I came off incapacity benefit, I was getting the disability element of working tax credit. Yeah. Because of the changes in benefits and the change from disability living allowance to personal independence payments, I lost that benefit. I then lost the disability element of my working tax credit. I'm a disabled person trying to work. I love my job. I want to work more than I do. But there are weeks when I just cannot work.
Yes.
And so actually what this has meant for me and like so many other people out there is that I've got into debt because of it. And because I literally cannot work full time. So when I hear that the Conservatives want to help disabled people in work and they're doing everything they can to support those of us who are working, it just makes me want to scream because the truth is so far removed from that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been the thing with this government and the previous governments is that they are and were both very good at rhetoric and spin, even in some respects, so much more so than Tony Blair ever was, really. And the amount of manipulated statistics and clever use of semantics which comes out of government departments regarding this is staggering. It's just a constant stream of denials that they're doing anything wrong. I mean, we had also this week David Gawk taken to Twitter to say that anyone who's saying that universal credit payments are effectively causing hardship and anxiety is causing anxiety to the people on universal credit. It's staggering. And you know as well as I do, the Canary has documented this a lot. I mean, we've had four United Nations reports, all of them slamming the government for its treatment of disabled people. And yet we still have this kind of shrugging of shoulders attitude, like, oh, no, we love disabled people. We're doing the best we can for them. And it's complete balderdash, isn't it, really?
Oh, absolutely. In February, it was reported, for example, that 50,000 people have lost their mobility vehicles. Sorry, in February, it was reported that 800 people a week are losing their mobility vehicles. And coming to Christmas, I've got a sister who's got a physical disability, and she's just going through this assessment. She needs her vehicle. It's the only way that she can get around, and it's adapted for her. But over the Christmas period, she's got all this stress and anxiety because she's worried that she's going to lose the only access that she has to independence. And this is the case for so many disabled people across the country who have been through this. So whenever you hear that the government cares about disabled people, they want to try and help them, it is just inexcusable. And it is just a real slap in the face to anybody who is trying to struggle, you know, who's struggling with their lives, but also wants to do the best with their lives as well and actually wants to get out there. They want to do things, want to live independent lives. Everything that the government is doing is taking away that independence.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and let's just be perfectly clear. It's beyond reasonable doubt to think that any government claims that they're doing the best for disabled people are true. It's just not true at all. I mean, the United Nations have repeatedly said it. Numerous external organisations, third sector organisations, disabled people's organisations have said that it's just not the case. And the statistics back it up. As you say, over 50,000 people have lost mobility vehicles. We had over 500,000 people, the UN claimed, had been subject to human rights violations due to government policies. 590 people, an Oxford University study found, had taken their own lives in part because of the work capability assessment. And I think it was 91 people a week between 2011 and 2014 were dying after the government told them they were fit for work. There's no inkling that the government are doing their best for disabled people. If anything, it could be viewed as a sustained ideological driven attack on some of the poorest people in our society. I mean, you'd sort of, after maybe 4 years, you'd go, oh, well, you know, it's austerity, it's policy, it's really unpleasant, but they, you know, they're doing it because they believe austerity is the only way forward. After 5 years, you begin to question it. After now nearly 8 years, it can't be seen as anything else than ideological dislike for what the Nazis referred to as useless eaters. And it's and many disabled people have made that comparison. I wrote it in an article once. And it can't be seen as anything more than that. However, there are always glimmers of hope, aren't there, Emily? And just on Thursday of this week, there was a victory in a court case where a woman who remained anonymous brought a legal challenge against the government over personal independence payments because the government changed the regulations early on this year and 160 64,000 people living with mental health issues were therefore denied the enhanced rate of PIP, personal independence payment. Court case was brought. The judges agreed that this was discriminatory against people living with mental health issues, and they said the law has to be quashed. So as things stand, currently 164,000 people are entitled to reapply for that benefit. We have to wait for the Court of Appeal process, which the government will probably do. But victories can happen. It's very easy sometimes with issues surrounding disability to get mired down in the gloom and the horrific nature of it all. But things can be changed, can't they, by decisive action.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in some ways, it was one of the reasons I wrote the article that I did the other day, because I have so much respect for the claimant who's brought this case, because the whole process is designed to bring you down, and it's designed to really grind you down as well. Yeah. And I had to give up on my appeal for PIP because it was affecting my mental health too much. And I actually got to the point where I had to prioritise my mental health over applying for the benefit that I was entitled to.
Yes.
And so this victory is great. And it is so important that we all keep telling these stories, we keep bringing these challenges, and we just keep on not allowing the government just to get away with it, just to whitewash disabled people, to whitewash these issues, and to get away with their rhetoric that, oh, we're helping disabled people back into work. Oh, you know, aren't we wonderful? Because, you know, we're changing behaviour, was what Gork said on Mar about sanctions. Like, yeah. No, you're not. You are punishing people. But yes, you're absolutely right. We can fight and we can win. And that's really important.
No, absolutely. And as I said previously, I cannot see this being anything other than ideologically driven attacks on disabled people. And I mean, it staggers me that the government still think they can keep doing this and flying in the face of the United Nations, ultimately, which gave its most damning verdict ever about what this government is doing to disabled people. But as we say, victories can happen. There is always something to fight for. And 2018, let's see what happens. We will discuss 2018 later. So, Emily, thank you for talking us through that. That's a subject extremely close to my heart. So thank you. And thank you for your candid honesty as well. Okay, so moving on, and now the ghost of Christmas present is appearing in the canary pod, and Freya, I think it's talking to you. You wrote an article this week on a viral message from an A&E consultant, which was quite. I saw this on Twitter and I was like, yeah, that would make an excellent story. That's damn brilliant. And it's just superb what this consultant said. Just talk us through it, and then we'll talk about the NHS more broadly.
So it was a doctor from Brighton, an A&E consultant called Rob Galloway, who spoke out as an informed consultant working on the front line in an A&E department about the crisis. And he said quite clearly that the staff, that the NHS is in meltdown, that our staff are at breaking point. And he said very clearly, we need your help. And one of the things he was referring to was that huge numbers of statistics and information about the NHS are not being accurately reported by the press. Mm-hmm. And he implored the press to ask different questions. And I'm assuming he's referring to the mainstream media here, but to ask the right questions and to really gauge quite how bad this crisis was. And, you know, as he said, patients are being left in corridors because there are no ward beds for them to go to. Staff are leaving shifts demoralised and exhausted. And most importantly, our patients are not getting the care that they deserve. And it was an incredibly brave statement, which I'm really glad went viral. At the time the story went out, it was at 10,000 shares on Facebook. It's now at 22,000. So clearly what he's saying is striking a chord with people, and I think it's this bravery from people who are working within the NHS speaking out about the crisis, because ultimately the crisis in the NHS is about life and death.
Yes.
And it's the bravery of people working within it. I've also heard through other NHS stories that increasingly people working within the NHS are too scared to speak out.
You preempted something I was going to say, actually, because absolutely. I mean, we should not underestimate just what it takes for a medical professional within the NHS to speak out, because it's extremely, firstly, it's extremely difficult legally. Obviously, there's whistleblowing legislation in place, but they're quite often putting their careers on the line as well by doing this, because they effectively work for the government. And we've seen it in the specific case of Dr. Chris Day. I don't know if you know about this, who was a whistleblower, and he faced the full force of Health Education England, the Department for Health, against him speaking out about specific things he had witnessed within the NHS, and he ultimately took them to court for damages of what they'd done to his career, and he did win that case. But they face a possible huge backlash in various areas, medical professionals speaking out, don't they?
And I don't think we should underestimate sort of quite and applaud Rob Galloway's bravery and honesty in standing up to share the truth about what is actually going on in A&E departments. And should there be any repercussions for him, I hope that there will be a huge amount of support behind him, because people need to know about this. You know, there is a lack of staff, there is a lack of beds, and ultimately this all comes down to a lack of funding, and along with many other things, you know, a systematic corrosion of the fundamental principles of the NHS. And the impact of this is now being seen across the country. And there is a very real possibility that in the beginning of this year, the Red Cross declared a humanitarian crisis in A&E departments. There is a huge likelihood that we're going to tip back into that again, because funding is even less than it was at that point. But there is also a very real concern that NHS England are going to try and limit stories about that getting out any further. So I think the more, you know, the bravery of the NHS staff and the more reporting we can do about exactly what is going on in and it's across the NHS, but I think the most acute sort of version of it is in A&E departments.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's kind of, this is a two-pronged issue, if you like. So let's touch on those. Firstly, obviously, Galloway says that A&Es are struggling because of frail elderly who need a ward bed but can't get one, and also because there's not enough beds in the hospital. So we have this issue again of the disparity between what's happening in social care in the community, don't we, and then the knock-on effects that's having on our hospitals, and also the lack of beds. So we have, first off, we have this issue of funding and cuts to social care and cuts to hospitals and A&E units, correct? That was my sort of take from...
Yeah, completely, which is... it's going back to Simon Stevens, who's the CEO of the NHS, what's known as his five-year forward view. Stevens worked in privatised healthcare in America and introduced something known as STPs, which is Sustainability and Transformation Partnerships. And what we're seeing now is, and there is a pretense with those that they're going to unify social care and NHS care and bring the two together, but it's not that simple in terms of funding streams, because the NHS is not means tested. Some aspects of social care are. So we're seeing a broken social care system alongside reduced budgets and the NHS being forced to reduce budgets. The next phase that we're just standing on the brink of, and, you know, in terms of thinking about the ghost of Christmas present, this may be the last winter we have the NHS as we know it. That is the level of crisis at the moment.
Because what's happening there?
Imminent. It's something known as ACOs, accountable care organizations, or in some areas in Cornwall they're being called accountable care systems, and these are being pushed through. It's a new model for funding which pretty much opens the door to privatization, where healthcare will then be, it will be led by profit.
And this is you've led nicely into, like, you read my mind, the second prong of what I want to talk about. So we've seen cuts to social care, cuts to funding for hospitals. That's one thing. And what a lot of people say is this privatisation by stealth of the health service that people suspect the Tories are attempting to do, isn't it? That's
yeah, absolutely. I mean, in Cornwall this week, there was a demonstration at a council meeting who are apparently going to lead an inquiry as to whether that is the best model for us to have, because our major hospital in Cornwall recently went into special measures. And that seems to be another trend that hospitals are being run into the ground. They're going to special measures. And from that point, it's almost as though there is leeway to bring in these new measures. Mm-hmm. I can say from having sat in the council meeting, it was an absolute whitewash. I don't know why they were calling it an inquiry. It pretty much looks like a foregone conclusion. And having witnessed people from NHS England discussing it, the implications of what's coming are truly terrifying. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be a foregone conclusion. All lip service to inquiry, to public opinion about it, seems to be pretty much quashed. And so I would say, yeah, this is very possibly, if we can't stand up to the imposition of accountable care organisations or systems, whatever they're going to call them, privatisation is on its way. And we've also seen Richard Branson, you know, fending huge, I think he got another contract, was it for 700 million? Or I should have checked out the number, but anyway, Branson.
He had one for 700 million. It was towards the start of the year. And then you got another one, I think it was for 80 million, I think.
The latest one. But companies like Virgin Healthcare are standing in the wings and they're ready to pounce. Because basically the NHS, when things are put out to tender, they know what it costs to run them. They can't agree to run some of those services for profit because they are not for-profit services. Private healthcare companies, on the other hand, are coming in offering tenders that appear to sort of give a sense that there is profit to be made from the provision of those services.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's kind of, it's the thing that a lot of campaigners and a lot of NHS professionals say, that there is this privatisation by stealth going on. The government fervently deny that this is happening, even in the face of statistics, for example, that the amount of money paid by the NHS to private independent companies has gone from, I think it was 4.2% up to 8.7% between 2010 and 2015. But no, we're not giving money to private companies. No. When that is happening. And then when you look at the historical evidence as well, I mean, this kind of approach by the government is well documented. It's kind of a disaster capitalist kind of approach where you beat something down so badly that the only option that you're left to sell to the public to be able to remedy it is privatisation
they're coming in to save us. I mean, in Cornwall, we've been sold this bit that this is to save us, and
exactly
the buzzwords being thrown around are just appalling. That it's about cooperation and it's about transparency. And yeah, I just witnessed a slide given by one of the main people from NHS England. And in one of the slides given to councillors, she said the bit in the middle is greyed out because it's too busy. And very clearly on that slide was the key information that anybody needed. And yet it was greyed out, so nobody could read that. And I'm trying to find out what was on that slide.
No, of course. I mean, the thing is, it's really worrying when you have councils in cahoots as well with the government over this. But the thing is, this tactic by capitalist, corporatist, neoliberal, whatever your preferred turn of phrase, this tactic by them is not new. I mean, we saw exactly the same thing with the rail industry in the 1980s and the 1990s. There was a systematic decimating of the public railways in this country, underfunding, decimating, negative press about how bad the services were, about it was in crisis. So the public was constantly on tender hooks about the industry until it got to the point where the major government said, well, no, look, this is failing. We'd best give it to private companies. And everyone was like, oh, all right, then, yeah, that'd be great. Now look at us. We have 3% rises in rail fares nearly every single year for the past few years. The services are a disaster. And they're employing the same tactic within the NHS, essentially. Yeah,
things are so bad in the NHS at the moment. This is going back to what Rob Galloway said about this key link between the breakdown in social care and the crisis in the NHS. There is a new role in hospitals now, and there are now corridor nurses who are being trained specifically people in corridors. And I personally witnessed this. I had to spend 12 hours in A&E, and around me, the majority of people in hospital on that day were elderly people. And as I left, the corridors were queuing up, the ambulances were full, and these corridor nurses are there to treat people in the corridors so that the ambulances can get back out to go and get more patients.
It's just unbelievable.
Talking about, you know, the ghosts of Christmas present, that's where we are this Christmas. There are now corridor nurses, and that's the point we've got to.
It's staggering. I mean, for me, what concerns me with this, and it concerns me quite greatly, is that regarding the NHS, we have seen campaign after campaign after campaign. We've seen massive protests in London. I was at several of them. I made a film about one of them. And yet nothing seems to stop the government. They will just railroad through any public opinion, the opinion of medical professionals, people within the healthcare industry. They will just railroad through it, and nothing seems to be able to stop them. I mean, is there anything more we can do apart from essentially voting in a Labour government to sort this out? I mean, because everything we've tried has so far failed.
Yeah, and, you know, there's another strand of it, which is the crisis and the lack of staff. It's been, Labour found out this week, there's now 100,000 vacancies. There's a shortage.
Really? I didn't see this.
There's shortage, and that includes 11,000 doctors and 40,000 nurses. So I think we can stand with those who are still working and broken in the healthcare profession. But I think we need to keep talking about this and keep raising those demands, because with that huge shortage, that's putting even more pressure on those people who are still there and still trying to work and save lives. And I think it's one of those issues we've got to keep the pressure on and not stop, not ever stop, but give our full support and solidarity to the people working in the NHS who are brave enough, like Rob Galloway was, to speak out about it.
No, absolutely. And I think that's a brilliant way to summarise the situation. I think while it seems that the Tories are unstoppable with this, I think it's extremely important, as you said, keep it in the public eye, keep it in the public consciousness, support people who are telling the truth about it. And also to challenge, as Galloway pointed out, the most of the media's reporting and the narrative that they peddle surrounding this. We have to keep challenging it and fighting for what many people consider to be the UK's greatest institution. So I think that's a really good summing up, Freya. And as a side note, Freya did an excellent piece on her 12-hour experience in A&E. We'll put it in the footnotes for this programme. Brilliant piece of writing and really insightful into the reality of what is happening in A&Es at the moment. So we'll put it in the footnotes and you can read it. It's a searing piece of writing. Brilliant. So Freya, that's great. Thank you so much. And so the talk of the NHS and what might only save it being a Labour government leads me nicely into the ghost of Christmas yet to come and John Ranson. Hello, John.
Hi, Steve.
So, Kerri-Anne wrote a very interesting piece this week about Jeremy Corbyn, and he turned a bit... turned a bit Mystic Meg, didn't he? And made some rather spooky predictions about the forthcoming year, and essentially believes he will be Prime Minister in 12 months. Just, you're kindly stepping in, Kerri-Anne. Just talk us through what Kerri-Anne wrote about, and then I think it's important that let's have a chat about 2018 and what we think it will hold for this country.
So Kerri-Anne wrote a piece on the 19th of December, entitled "When Will You Become Prime Minister? Jeremy Corbyn Answers the Big Question." And she was actually reporting on an interview that Corbyn had given to Grazia magazine. And to be honest,
the cutting edge of political analysis.
It's probably the first time that we've actually used Grazia magazine as a source in one of our articles, because we normally like to go for things that aren't quite so glossy and celebrity filled. But in this interview with Grazia, Jeremy Corbyn said that there would probably be another election in the next 12 months. Mm-hmm. And he also said, "I will probably win. I'm ready to be Prime Minister tomorrow." And the thing is, I don't think that anyone could say that he was actually being kind of boastful or big-headed or anything like that, because before it came out that he'd made those comments, it had also been reported that, for example, Morgan Stanley Bank had a report done, because investment banks, they're always getting reports on what's likely to happen in the future. Basically, if you want to know what's going to happen in the future, the best people to ask are investment banks or bookmakers, because they put a lot of effort into working out which way the cards are going to fall you know, in the future so they can get on the winning side. Yes. And they said that it was likely, that was their word, that there would be a general election in 2018. So Corbyn saying there'll be a general election in 2018, he's simply going with, you know, what the experts in crystal ball gazing are also saying.
Absolutely. And it also came off the back, there was some interesting polling done as well.
Well, there was. And yeah, I was going to lead into that to say that it's not big-headed either to say I will probably win, because we can look at particularly the demographics, the age breakdown of voting in the 2017 general election. And it actually revealed very clearly that the key determinant now in whether people are likely to vote Labour or are likely to vote Conservative is their age. And that actually trumps things like socioeconomic status or even necessarily where they live in the country. It's mostly age, to the point where the graph suggests that when you hit 50, that's the tipping point between more likely to vote Labour and more likely to vote Conservative. Okay. So I'm strapping myself in for when it happens. It won't be too far away, and hopefully I can dodge it somehow. At the moment, and Michael Heseltine made this point very clearly back in June, roughly 2% of the electorate is dying off of old age in any given year. And in any given year, roughly 2% of the electorate is coming in at the bottom. And Heseltine pointed out that of the 2% dying off at the top end, roughly 70% of them are likely to be Tory voters. And of the 2% coming in at the bottom, the youngsters, roughly 70% of them are likely to be Labour voters. And he made the point that that pattern really hasn't got to continue for very long at all before the Conservatives are looking at their vote quite literally dying out.
There is no other way to say it, really, is there?
No.
Voters are literally dying.
They are, and that's just a provable fact based on statistics. But there was another poll that came out in the last week that looked at support for political parties among students, and it found that support for Labour, which had been at 55% among 18 to 24-year-olds just before the general election, has now risen to 68% by the report came out on 18th of December. And so this suggests as well, along with the demographics from the election, that the voting preferences of the British electorate are only going in one direction. Tories are dying out. More and more Labour voters are coming in at the younger end. And so it certainly looks, you know, you've only got to draw a couple of graphs, and it seems highly likely that if there was an election in 2018, that Labour would win. Of course, let's nothing's ever cut and dried, but that does look like the case.
Yeah, it's never cut and dried, as you say, but the polling is certainly interesting. And I mean, for a very, very, very senior Conservative to go on record and basically assert that the Conservatives are dying out is quite, it's quite a bold move, if you like.
I think he was being searingly honest. He was trying to shock his party into taking that situation seriously.
No, absolutely. I mean, Heseltine's kind of in the same vein as Ken Clark, though, isn't he? He's a very sort of traditional Tory, if you like, who doesn't go very well with PR and spin. He just does say it like it is. And it's fascinating to see that. I think what's interesting with this is obviously we have the conundrum of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, don't we? So, which stipulates that you can't have a general election until the 5th of May 2022 unless several things happen. So, what are those things? And in your opinion, I'm going to put you on the spot here, John, because Kerry-Ann did this to me the other week and I had to give my opinion. So, it's your turn now. What's about the Fixed Term Parliaments Act? And in your opinion, neck on the line, do you think there'll be an election next year? 2 points. Go, go, go.
So the first point is that we could only have early elections if certain conditions are satisfied. There would have to be a motion in the House of Commons, which would have to be agreed by either at least 2/3 of the whole House, or it'd have to be passed on a show of hands, like a unanimous vote. Or there would have to be a motion of no confidence passed in the government, and then no alternative government able to be formed within 14 days after the passing of that. And obviously, as we've seen recently with an electoral defeat for the government over one of the Brexit amendments, they are close to the tipping point where they've only got to have a few Conservatives rebel, or, for example, the Democratic Unionist Party to withdraw its support, and suddenly the numbers don't look terribly good for the government. Those are possibilities. And the likes of Morgan Stanley and apparently some officials within the European Union as well are looking at the situation with the government. They're looking at the fact that ministers are kind of being shed at a rate of knots, at the fact that the government is struggling to pass legislation. It's having to drop things from its manifesto that May lurches between looking like she's just about in charge and looking like she's not in charge in the slightest. And they're saying that they just can't really see the government limping on for that long.
It's staggering, isn't it?
Some people thought it wouldn't make it to Christmas. Well, it's just about got that far, but you know how far into the new year it lasts is hard to say.
I would
love to see an election next year because everything that Emily has said and that Freya has said, just backs up what an absolute disaster for the country the Conservative Party is. Yeah. And it really is of the utmost urgency that we get them out of government before they can do any more damage. As it stands, it's going to take a lot of rebuilding to get the country back on its feet. So it really can't come too soon. If you're asking me to put my neck on the line, I would say yes, probably. I'll use Jeremy Corbyn's word and say probably.
Well, look, John, I would be in agreement with you. I was only discussing this last night with my girlfriend. If you look at what's happened this week, late on Wednesday evening, we saw Damien Green go. Did he resign? Was he pushed? The letter from Theresa May seemed quite clear on that. She said, "I asked you to resign." So he was effectively sacked. I mean, another cabinet minister gone. As you say, there's indications from Morgan Stanley, who, as you quite rightly pointed out, they wouldn't say these things if they weren't financially, because that's what it's all about, financially confident that the government may well fall in 2018. But there are these restrictions. But it's just, I mean, Rachel Swindon, the young lady on Twitter, who's a now prominent Twitter user, she's summed up nicely with a tweet on Wednesday night. She tweeted to the Conservatives and she said, "You can't even sort out a collapsing government properly. Will you just hurry up and go?" And it kind of says it all. It's absolutely, I think I was saying to my girlfriend last night, historians will look back at this period in history and it will be viewed as unprecedented politically, I think, for all just perpetual chaos. Because it's just, you cannot write this stuff as satire. And as you quite rightly say, on a serious note, there's been so much damage done, being done, and will be done if this government continues. There has to come a point where this ends somehow. It's just obviously difficult because of the legal limitations of it. But I'm not sure how much more chaos I can put up with. And then, of course, you had the added caveat of who the hell would replace Theresa May? Because everyone at the forefront of the Conservative Party is some way tarnished now. There's very few people left who have got clean noses, if you like.
No, totally. There's been talk, hasn't there, about getting some kind of old hand to take over so that it would give time for all the young pups to sort of actually get any sort of public profile at all. They've been doing their best with Dominic Raab recently, haven't they, putting him up quite a bit. Here's the next generation. But then the talk was of putting David Davis up as an interim prime minister. And this is the guy who said about his role as Brexit secretary, "I don't have to be clever."
But he's prime minister material, John. Then.
Well, maybe he's. Yeah, at the front of the queue. If ever there was a Jim Hacker type candidate, it would be him, I think.
You think they might ask Tony Blair?
Well, possibly. And he might possibly be prepared to take the whip and sit on the blue benches. Who knows?
Yeah. Just to throw this open now. What are your thoughts? Emily, general election next year, yes or no? And your reasoning, please.
Am I just allowed to say I hope so?
Yeah, you speak for the nation, Emily.
We bloody need one, as John was just saying, for all the reasons outlined. It's, I mean, people's lives depend on it. All our lives depend on it. You know, our NHS depends on it. We need this general election. And if we don't have one next year, we need to be out on the streets forcing a general election. We can't be waiting for Theresa May to decide, oh, I'm going to give up on this power that I've really tried to grab hold of. And, you know, she's doing everything she can to cling on. So we need to force a general election if one isn't called. It's got to come from us.
Spot on. Freya, your thoughts?
I think I agree with Emily. I think there has to be. There absolutely has to be. It's even beyond I hope so now. And I think that's a really good point. It has to be forced because the level of destruction that they're wreaking is just too much. And people are dying because of it. And on that basis alone, there has to be. And I really hope that this time Labour sort their shit out as well. And that the infighting that's been going on, and stand behind Corbyn, and that there will be a general election and we can issue some serious change and quite literally save lives.
Absolutely. I think, look, this has been a fairly, in some respects, light-hearted episode of the podcast. I've taken a funny slant on events that are happening now, but the reality of it is just as John and Emily and Freya said, that people's lives do depend on this. I've known people myself who have died at the hands of this government, essentially because of cuts to benefits that are happening. There's homeless people on the streets who are dying. There's 4 million children living in poverty. That's the nuts and bolts of this. Sometimes it's good to put a slightly humorous slant on it, because if you didn't laugh, you'd just end up crying for most of the day. And you have to do that sometimes. However, it is literally deadly serious what is happening to this country and what this government is doing. And I think we could all be agreed that there is now a real need to get them out of Westminster as quickly as possible. And as Freya rightly said, Labour need to get their shit together and be ready to do this. So I think it's a very serious subject. They're all very serious subjects. And the seriousness of it has to be got across, that they have to go as soon as possible. That was excellent. John, thank you for your contribution. And Freya, Emily, that was superb. Thank you very much for guiding us through a Brexmas carol this week.
Can I just share one final thing from Mr. Dickens in honour of your brilliant off the perch as well, Steve, which has been great. And Dickens said in A Christmas Carol, "It is a fair, even-handed, noble adjustment of things that while there is infection in disease and sorrow, there is nothing in the world so irresistibly contagious as laughter and good humour."
Freya, that was masterful. Thank you so much. Perfect way to end this Christmas edition of the Canary Pod. Guys, thank you very much, and I hope you have a fab Christmas and New Year as well.
Thank
Bye.
You.
So that's us done for another week, and actually us done for this year on Canary Pod. Please make sure you follow us on Twitter at Canary Pod. Use the hashtag Canary Pod to carry on the discussion, and also make sure you review and subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever platform you're listening to us on. It helps more people find us and it helps more people listen to us too. So from everyone at the Canary, I'd like to wish all our listeners and all our readers a very happy Christmas and a peaceful and hopeful new year. And we'll see you in 2018. Remember, don't get angry, get involved.